scale. Studies have shown that today's large corporations are less likely to invest their research in radical innovations and more likely to focus on improving existing technology. But by being so efficient and rational in their use of resources, they also may be neglecting the necessarily inefficient process of making technology even more efficient. Sometimes intellectual property was virtually given away, as we have seen of Bell Labs' transistor and IBM's relational database concept. There was often a generous public spirit in these organizations. The Shell Oil Company granted to Princeton University Press the royalty-free use of the printing plates for one of its prized resources, a stratigraphic atlas of North and Central America, when it decided to have it published in the mid-1970s. It could have been a lucrative project, but Shell executives of the energy boom era valued academic goodwill when the industry was competing for geoscience graduates above additional profits. All Shell required, and it was readily granted, was a low-priced, spiral-bound edition. In the rise of Silicon Valley, it was not necessarily the pioneers of theory and pure research, but the agile, so-called fast followers who dominated their industries. Xerox PARC developed the graphic personal computer interface and mouse, but was unable to manufacture systems at an acceptable price. The Apple Macintosh transformed computing with Xerox's technology. It did not help that the top Xerox executives of the 1970s were veterans of Robert McNamara's cost-slashing ethos at Ford Motor Company, not visionary entrepreneurs like Joseph C. Wilson, who had retired in 1966 after transforming a previously quiet family business in Kodak's shadow. Some economists believe that even if ample funds were available for fundamental market-creating innovations, they are much rarer now, that over the past 200 years, from continuous process industrialization to the post-industrial age of the platform, we have invented all the basics and have reached a point of diminishing returns. As we have seen, the favorite metaphor of economists like Robert J. Gordon and Tyler Cowen is that we have harvested the low-hanging fruit. The historian of military technology, David Edgerton, has shown just how much of today's technology is a refinement of older ideas. Even the electric car is based on the 25-year-old principle of the lithium-ion battery. Most improvements have been in software control. The technology analyst G. Pascal Zachary has lamented that, contrary to popular impression, the specter of stagnation looms over the world's innovators. Low-hanging fruit is nowhere to be seen in fields as crucial as digital electronics, biomedical devices, or space technology. Against this viewpoint is the optimism of other economic historians, notably Joel Mokyr, who argue that while the fruit may be higher, improved instruments are letting us build taller ladders. Platforms like Google, Facebook, and Amazon do many things more rapidly and cheaply than previous technology. But their form of efficiency does not do much to make society as a whole more efficient in the way that, for example, a battery or microchip based on a new principle could. Yet the world's present financial institutions do not seem to be harvesting the fruit picked from Mokyr's long ladders. The paradox of efficiency is that progress toward greater efficiency is wasteful. A succession of management doctrines has promised to slash costs and reduce overhead, thus increasing profits and shareholder value in the short run. Yet, in companies with an innovative culture, this strategy can threaten long-term growth. One famous experiment was the implementation of a concept called Six Sigma at the 3M Corporation, known for blockbuster products from cellophane tape in the 1930s, to sticky notes in the 1980s. Jeff Nicholson, creator of the Post-it note and later a 3M public relations ambassador, believes that the search for predictably profitable innovations at 3M and elsewhere has been a failure. The Six Sigma process killed innovation at 3M, he told the technology website ZDNet.com. Initially, what would happen in 3M with Six Sigma people, they would say they need a 5-year business plan for a new idea. Come on. We don't know yet because we don't know how it works. We don't know how many customers will take it up. We haven't taken it out to the customer yet. The frontier in the agenda of Silicon Valley is not in industrial processes or business decision-making, but in the home where networked appliances would communicate in an Internet of Things. The best known reservations about these plans come from security experts who correctly observe how easy it might be to hack domestic technology if even the sites of government agencies, including the CIA itself, from which secrets have been repeatedly disclosed to WikiLeaks, and major corporations have turned out to be disturbingly insecure. This means at best that much of whatever time is saved by electronic intercommunication will be consumed by monitoring and updating security software. Since the Internet of Things will also integrate products and software from many manufacturers, it will also be a challenge for households to resolve inevitable conflicts and miscommunication, which are likely to grow as the square of the number of products connected. The irony of the efficiency movement is that in its latest and most domesticated form, it is not about optimization of resources at all, except in conservation of energy by more sophisticated web-connected thermostats and in theoretical savings from app-based light switches. And even these are vulnerable. The New York Times correspondent Nick Bilton reported in January 2016 that a still undiagnosed failure of the software of the advanced Nest thermostat caused rapid drainage of a battery that in turn allowed his home temperature to drop to 64 degrees Fahrenheit, a rude awakening for his infant. Such a failure, he continued, could lead not only to discomfort, but to burst pipes and major damage. Silicon Valley's terms of use also make recovery of damages much more difficult than they are when old-style electromechanical equipment fails. In a system of interdependent information-sharing appliances, one such glitch could easily cascade, sending the rest into their own failure modes a la Rube Goldberg or Jacques Tati. It might be tragic rather than funny. Even the apparently innocent app-controlled LED light bulb can, researchers have shown, allow hackers to seize control of a home's entire lighting and turn on strobe and other effects. Internet of Things enthusiasts may object that there are means to safeguard home networks against hacking, but it's hardly efficient to spend time configuring network settings in order to save the effort of getting up to adjust a lamp. In fact, it may be counterproductive, since frequent brief interruptions of sedentary work and leisure make us fitter and more alert. A number of desktop programs and mobile apps have been designed to encourage standing up and moving. Many experts and journalists consider the Internet of Things to be the final payoff of the quest for efficiency in its latest networked form. While it does offer the largely commoditized appliance industry a chance to join in electronic planned obsolescence and premium pricing, it also sadly illustrates how sophistication can mask a technological dead end. Silicon Valley executives may well enjoy coming home to a world that is an extension of the network management issues they address at work, just as watch collectors enjoy expensive and observable complications like chronometers and moon phases that they are unlikely to use. Yet the Nest episode shows why many other consumers may think twice. What are needed are products and services that not just do existing things more smoothly, but extend our capabilities as the Xerox photocopier did. To do this, we must recognize that fundamental innovation is inefficient, and that it takes a kind of intuition and commitment that Six Sigma programs and other systems are not able to model. The economist Albert O. Hirschman, reflecting on development projects, adapted Adam Smith's idea of the invisible hand of the marketplace to the hiding hand of new ventures. If humanity had consistently known the obstacles to its greatest projects in advance, it might not have attempted them. Hirschman cited Martin Luther's reflection that if God had revealed to him all he would have to go through to reform the church, he never would have begun it, but instead, God had given him blinkers like a horse. We spur ourselves on by exaggerating future benefits. Hirschman also quotes the Polish philosopher Leszek Kołakowski's metaphor of a caravan painfully making its way through the desert from one watering hole to the next, drawn on by mirages of gorgeous scenes ahead. No people has been more affected by this mentality, for better or worse, than Americans. In fact, self-delusion, underestimation of risk, and overestimation of profit, rather than strict rationality, were the true driving forces of the expansion of American society. Many of the voyages in the Age of Exploration, Spanish, Portuguese, and French, as well as English, were carried out with maps and instruments woefully inadequate by today's standards, and often with little knowledge of the indigenous people. If the true risks had been known, there would still have been some bold adventurers, but not necessarily equally optimistic investors. We are familiar with the dismal rate of success of gold rush prospectors, but mining in general was blessed or cursed with the hiding hand. The historical anthropologist Anthony F.C. Wallace, analyzing the high disaster rates of a group of 19th century Pennsylvania anthracite mines, found that the entrepreneurs systematically underestimated the frequency of fires, explosions, and floods. Sources suggest that the investors regarded themselves less as calculating profit seekers than as heroes of industry. And despite the appalling injury rate, the miners, independent workers hiring out their own labor, also were proud of courting danger. The great engineering projects of the 19th and early 20th centuries presented one unforeseen obstacle after another, and there were spectacular failures, like the collapse of the original Panama Canal project of France's most celebrated engineer, Ferdinand de Lesseps. The American Canal project that succeeded it surmounted almost incalculable obstacles of its own. We have already noted the extreme risks facing the development of jet engines before their triumph in safety and economy, and near disasters during the 20-year path from the original xerography patent to the introduction of a safe and economical office machine. Even the space program, from the original Apollo missions to the latest plans for manned flight to Mars, reveals the hiding hand. Consider the alarming 4% fatality rate of space missions, peril probably not fully foreseen. At least one former astronaut, Rick Hauck, has acknowledged that he never would have entered the program if he had known the risk. The doctrine of efficiency in making our decisions more rational may also be limiting our aspirations. Many of Silicon Valley's own favorite success stories are not about the rational calculation of risks and rewards using historical and market data and algorithms, but about intuitive self-confidence. Bill Gates, Paul Allen, and Mark Zuckerberg all dropped out of college, although data clearly show it generally pays to complete an undergraduate degree. Each had a correct intuition, not supported by hard data, that he had an opportunity that would not wait. When Jeff Bezos, who did finish his engineering degree, was a young star of quantitative hedge fund management, he also knew that strictly rationally, the odds were against his plan for internet commerce. His reason for leaving a career that promised to be even more lucrative was that whatever happened, he did not want to be sorry at 80 that he had not tried to seize the opportunity, analysis he has called a regret minimization framework. David Shaw, Bezos's employer and a former computer science professor, took a strictly data-based, rational approach and let his protege depart. Neither the redistributionism of the left nor the market-driven doctrines of Silicon Valley can take us beyond platform efficiency. It is indeed possible that, as Robert Gordon and others believe, we have exhausted technology's real bargains and that computer power will stagnate. But we cannot afford to assume that it will. Nor is it enough to say that we should return to the often irrational heroic risk-taking of 19th-century business, if only because it took what we now consider unacceptable chances with human life as well as with capital. Rather, we need to acknowledge the hiding hand and find ways to reward the risks of the inefficient process of real innovation. Chapter 2. The Failed Promise of the Information Explosion. How the quest to measure elite science empowered populist culture. The platform economy took shape in the 1990s and early 2000s so gradually that it became obvious only in hindsight. Amazon.com was still an online retailer. Web Services Cloud Platform was not launched until 2002. Napster, the first peer-to-peer music sharing service, was established only in 1999. The famous, and sometimes notorious, Encyclopedia Britannica salespeople were still going strong in the early 1990s. But their true competitor was not an online service, but a Microsoft-produced version of the second or third tier Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedia, rebranded as Encarta. The information economy was still one of discrete physical products. Even the technological avant-garde of multimedia educational CD-ROMs produced by the Voyager company were not available online, and still are not, years after Voyager has ceased to exist. A pioneering analysis of network economics for a business audience in 1999, Carl Shapiro and Hal R. Varian's Information Rules, said almost nothing about either music file sharing, search, or social networks. Improvements in hardware, increasing speed of internet connections, and Apple's iTunes platform for licensing digital music, together with the rise of mobile information devices after 2005, made a true platform information economy possible. Historians usually are skeptical of claims of unprecedented change. But the two decades, beginning in the mid-1990s, were just such a time. There was a deep discontinuity between the world of 1989, when the still-flourishing Print Britannica reached its peak of sales after a decade of PCs and 5 years of Macintosh computers, and that of 2012, when Britannica ceased print production. The efficiency of access to texts and images over the Internet seemed at that point, prematurely, to herald the disappearance of physical media entirely. No surprise was more striking than the rise of search engines. In February 2002, I attended a scenario planning workshop at a California resort, a free-form exercise in imagining alternative futures, on the preservation of digital information, sponsored by the Library of Congress. One of the open questions was how Google, already essential for access to the online record, would ever become self-sustaining. I recall one participant raising the possibility that the federal government would need to take over Google as a national resource. None of us laughed or proposed instead that the still-fledgling company was about to become the most successful advertising agency in history. Yet little more than 2 years later, the company's profits had soared to $286 million annually, and its 2004 initial public offering established its market capitalization at $23 billion. In 2010, W. Russell Newman, whose work we encountered in Chapter 1, and his students at the University of Michigan were able to quantify the changes in information supply and demand in ways that had eluded intellectual historians. Surveying the average newspapers, magazines, recent books, and television and radio channels available in U.S. households in 1960, they estimated that a typical family had access to a little less than 100 hours of content, taking average reading speed into account for the print materials, for every hour they actually spent watching, listening, or reading. Newman was referring to the radio and television stations, magazines, newspapers, and recently published books available in the average home, not to public or academic library resources. Considering similar families, their study examined all the digital as well as conventional sources available to them, and concluded that the ratio was by 2005 over 2,900, or about 2 weeks of unique content for every minute of every day spent consuming information. This seemed to be the information explosion so many futurists had perceived and predicted in earlier decades. Newman and his collaborators did not accept the corollary drawn by many media prophets and critics that the public was smothered and even stupefied by overload. Newman argued for a successful adaptation of human behavior in choosing information, a transition from push to pull. The classic information regime of the continuous process era made available a limited number of products to consumers. Television and radio channels, recorded music and printed books in stores and libraries, at most a few local newspapers and a handful of national general interest magazines. The positive side of these limits was a shared moderate outlook unfavorable to radical conservative or socialist ideas, a mindset epitomized by a handful of trusted television network anchors and syndicated newspaper columnists. Despite the radical change, few people in the platform era appear to feel overwhelmed, according to the study, because they have developed a new way to consume information. Instead of monitoring relatively few sources, they are more likely to seek out those that are linked to or recommended by other sources or by friends and colleagues. As the internet grew, a delicious libertarian spirit emerged. It not only was possible to make a fortune while remaining true to one's ideas, it was helpful to have a radical outlook. Wired, the flagship of Silicon Valley culture, was heavy with advertising. Its founding executive editor, Kevin Kelly, made his book Out of Control available free on the web. Sales of the printed version continued to flourish. For a decade, many newspaper and magazine publishers seemed to have the best of both worlds, a new source of advertising revenue online that could more than offset the decline of print. National publications could offer advertisers what they appeared to want, an affluent and educated public. Content is king became a mantra. Since periodical readers were accustomed to advertising, so-called banner ads disturbed few, at least until more intrusive pop-up advertising appeared. Still, the explosion of free websites, including those of small businesses and individuals, changed information habits. In the emerging era of information abundance, documented by Newman and his colleagues, selecting sites to visit, pulling information rather than having it pushed, was a challenge. Two complementary services appeared, the portal and the search engine. Portals, sites that organized and listed web resources like Yahoo, America Online, and Excite, employed people to select sites they believed would be of greatest interest to their subscribers. When search was expensive, trained professionals would translate queries into tight arguments for precise results. Some of them had degrees from schools of library and information science. Others had equivalent experience. As misleading and even deceptive sites sprang up, these guides selected only the most genuine ones. But the concept of expert human guidance already seemed obsolescent in the mid-1990s. The initials in Yahoo's name wryly acknowledged the situation. Yet another hierarchical, officious oracle. This strategy attracted millions of users in the late 1990s, but had a fatal problem. New sites and pages were appearing faster than professional curators could evaluate them. Sites and pages within them also disappeared or were renamed. Controversies entangled portal managers' classification schemes. Should Messianic Judaism be classified as Jewish by self-identification and the origin of many adherents, or as Christian by its evangelical theology? The professionals could not avoid time-consuming religious, ethnic, and political controversies that could be challenging to resolve to all parties' satisfaction. Classification was, in addition, only part of what users expected. They wanted to be able to search the web for specific information. The new platform companies had to be reference librarians as well as information selectors. This was even more difficult because of the limits of early search software. Most website owners allowed software programs called spiders to examine their pages and build indexes, enabling users to discover those pages that matched their searches. This could work well if a user was looking for something unusual, like references to papers written about a rare species. It was not so easy to search for a common expression, like a celebrity's name. Search software had no efficient way to rank pages by quality. A search by relevance would list pages according to the frequency with which an expression appeared. But, true to Campbell's law, the ubiquity of attempts to game measurement systems, site owners could stack the odds in their own favor by including hundreds of hidden copies of a word. Inexperienced users of early search engines like AltaVista, which at one point indexed the highest number of pages, encountered the behavior immortalized in the early programmer's maxim, "A computer doesn't do what you want it to do. It does what you tell it to do." The search engines reported results dutifully and literally because they had no way of inferring what users really wanted. For example, they were not good at searching for synonyms. A search for dieting might not turn up a major article on weight loss if it did not use that exact word. This was an annoyance for lay surfers of the open web, but it was an economic risk for professionals using databases like Dialog that build by time. For many early databases, skilled library specialists had to work with scholars and scientists to formulate a string of included and excluded words, sometimes further limited by their proximity to each other, to minimize time on the meter. Only later, in the 1990s, did it become common for libraries to license databases for free research by their registered users. Many of these databases had been professionally indexed by subjects and keywords. The open web was still hit or miss, highly inefficient. The philosopher and technology critic David Weinberger has identified the central problem that Yahoo and other portals faced. From the Middle Ages through most of the 20th century, cultural authorities tried to establish classification systems to put human knowledge in orderly categories. Melville Dewey, the founder of American professional librarianship and the entrepreneur who developed the modern file card, established a numerical order that, despite the 1876 vintage biases noted by Mr. Weinberger, including religious Eurocentrism and elevation of the paranormal, has remained remarkably serviceable even now. Computer books fit neatly into the 004s at my local public library, for example. But with the explosion of the number of titles and of interdisciplinary and hybrid subjects, top-down schemas became less and less useful. The web, in particular, was organized by chains of backward and forward links defying any single order. One book, article, or image may have dozens of possible keywords or user-supplied tags. Weinberger's title exaggerates, but is still on target. Everything is miscellaneous. In the late 1990s, nobody seemed to have predicted a solution to this bottleneck, the kind of problem that the historian of technology, Thomas P. Hughes, adapting military jargon, called a reverse salient, a pocket of resistance in an advancing front of efficiency. Even optimistic futurists do not always expect them. The transistor, for example, overcame the problems of power consumption, heat, and failure of vacuum tube technology. Before its introduction, even the great science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke was dissuaded from filing a patent for the communications satellite of the future he had described because vacuum tubes burned out so quickly and astronauts would be needed to replace them. The Google PageRank algorithm was a comparably radical innovation. Without needing any new kind of hardware, it began to solve the nagging problem of search, giving people more or less what they want rather than what they've asked for. PageRank is only one part of Google's ever-changing and largely secret algorithm today. Transparency has inherent limits. If the details were known and understood, like those of Google's open-source Android software, they would be too easy to exploit. While the patent's equations are formidably technical, the principle was, like many other deep ideas, obvious in retrospect. Instead of relying mainly on professionals to select sites, they have a role at Google even now. Google's algorithm computes sites' connections to each other. It takes a populist approach rooted paradoxically in the organized elitism of scientific bibliography. In the mid-1950s, Eugene Garfield, with degrees in chemistry and library science, launched a service that tracked the references of scientific, engineering, and medical, and later of some social science and humanities, journals. A subscriber to the printed Science Citation Index could look up how often each paper had been cited by other papers, and by whom. Instead of asking experts to rank peers according to their subjective judgment, academic deans and industrial employers could see whose papers were considered important enough to be cited by other papers, especially by authors who themselves had been cited most often. The research community was thus constantly and indirectly ranking each other. It was also writing its own history, recording the links among researchers and helping them keep up with their fields as the number of journals continued to proliferate, for example, by identifying every paper that cited one's own work or a colleague's. As a bibliographic aid, citation indexes were applauded. As a measure of quality, they had critics from the outset, academics who considered them poor substitutes for traditional qualitative means, like soliciting letters. I remember lunch in a Chinese restaurant in the 1980s with one of my former mathematics professors and his indignation at the very concept. He declared he was going to write a letter of protest to Dr. Garfield, though I'm not sure he ever did. As a science book editor, I found such indexes almost useless in identifying prospective authors. I'll have more to say about citation indexing's other problems later. What is relevant here is how many people in the scientific world were using this form of measurement by the late 1990s, especially once the results could be found electronically rather than looked up year by year in big printed volumes or later CD-ROMs. The Institute for Scientific Information, which Garfield sold to the international media company Thomson Reuters, went online as the Web of Science in 1997. By 2009, the Web of Knowledge, as it had been renamed after multiple expansions, included 23,000 journals and 700 million references going back to the early 19th century. In 2016, it was sold to private equity funds as part of a package of other Thomson Reuters services. A Nature article reported that it was still highly profitable and likely to be resold. When two Stanford computer science graduate students, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, were developing their own search engine around the time the Web of Science went online, they were aware of Garfield's approach to indexing, as well as others, and cited his work in U.S. Patent 6,285,999, Method for Node Ranking in a Linked Database, possibly the most profitable single patent of all time, though the algorithm of the present Google search engine has become far more complex. PageRank, like the Web of Science, showed how backward and forward links, in one case footnotes, in the other web page locations embedded as so-called hypertext, usually visible to readers only as highlighting, could show how influential a source was. In the first case, a journal, in the second, a website. Just as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and their international peers are linked by countless online publications and blogs, so papers in Nature, Science, the New England Journal of Medicine, The Lancet, and the like are cited much more often than those in more specialized publications. Conversely, an article in one of those journals is more likely to be worth reading if it is cited often in one of the higher-ranking journals. For better and worse, citation analysis helped establish a quantitatively grounded pecking order among publications, affecting scientists' and managers' behavior, as my former teacher had feared. Of course, there was much more to Google's rise than the original concept. As a startup, Google originally indexed fewer pages than its competitors and returned fewer hits to queries. But early users found that its results were closer to what they wanted to find. Google didn't have all the answers, but it often found good ones more efficiently. And its indexing software, the spiders that crawled the web, were reprogrammed to reduce their effects on the site's performance. This efficiency had a cost. The vast server farms needed to store copies of crawled pages in response to user requests consumed corresponding energy and generated corresponding heat. The result seemed worth it. Google's algorithm and that of its main rival, Microsoft's Bing, know, for example, where a user is and the likely purpose of many requests. When Daniel M. Russell, a Google executive who held the enviable title of Uber Tech Lead for Search Quality and User Happiness, spoke at Princeton in 2012, I asked in the question and answer session whether the company was working on improving the quality of the highest ranking results. He replied that users' ideas of relevance and reliability varied by location and culture. In response to medical queries, for example, acupuncture and other alternative medicine ranked lower, he observed, on the East Coast of the United States than in East Asian cities. The efficiency of search using PageRank and similar algorithms has not necessarily been synonymous with effectiveness, giving searchers the best possible result. While Google was still conducting Yahoo's searches in 2002, for example, one study compared Google's own ranking of the relevance of search results with that of elite human judges, professors and graduate students at the University of Toronto. The judges agreed strongly with each other's ranking, a correlation of 0.475 out of 1.0, but not with the search engines, a correlation of only 0.173. I have not found any similar studies published since then, but it is well known that Google and Bing employ human scorers to check on the quality of results. This might not be a serious problem if two reasonable conditions were met. First, people are willing to look beyond the first page of results, and second, that they usually have the background knowledge to evaluate them. Unfortunately, they are not and don't. In fact, Daniel Russell's studies of Google users revealed some surprising gaps in basic computer skills. Only 1 in 10, for example, was aware of one of the most efficient shortcuts, Control-F, Command-F in the Mac operating system, for finding every occurrence of a keyword. It's an exaggeration to say that Google and the Internet make us stupid, as the technology critic Nicholas Carr argued in an article followed by a widely read book, The Shallows. Google and Bing do change intellectual habits, and in principle can help free us from memorization to more creative thinking. But Carr and other critics, like William Poundstone, are right in noting that using the web creatively demands background knowledge to recognize which algorithm-served links are likely to be of highest quality. Professionals, at least we assume, have this knowledge. A physician, lawyer, or social scientist knows the reputation of publishers and journals and the biases of their policies, and can easily reorder the algorithm's priorities. Users of academic databases like JSTOR do this routinely. Serious amateurs also can quickly see what is most relevant. Ideally, our personal memory and our electronic resources share the work of knowledge. Each concentrates on what it does best, understanding fundamental principles and facts on one side, accessing massive data on the other, for both efficiency and effectiveness. The real problem is that search engines, as they exist, even ones limited to supposedly more reliable information like Google Scholar, are inefficient ways to absorb an unfamiliar subject. The user needs the very knowledge that he or she is hoping to find, an idea going back to Plato's dialogue Meno, which raises the question of how a person can learn without already knowing. To make things worse, uninformed people don't always recognize their ignorance. Some of them, according to research by the social psychologists Justin Kruger and David Dunning, are sometimes firmest about topics they know least about. Another investigator, Brendan Nyhan, found that many people confronted with acknowledged facts challenging their views respond by reaffirming their positions. Search engines aid this tendency by making it easy to find information confirming just about any opinion. So despite Google's original declared mission statement of organizing the world's information and making it useful, it can be no better than the knowledge and attitudes of users. The outcome is that fewer than 9% of all Google searchers look beyond the first page of results, and about a third choose the top-rated link. Even in global politics and security, search engine optimization can have bizarre consequences, making the search for high-quality information inefficient. Governments around the world spend many billions of dollars on anti-terrorism programs, yet searches for information on jihadism yield overwhelmingly pro-jihadi views. For instance, the Arabic word khalifa, pan-Islamic state or caliphate, returns links to 9 extremist sites to 1 neutral one. In this case, Google may begin to make an exception to the neutrality of its algorithm or modify it to yield more acceptable results when the unfiltered ones might seem disparaging to a group. Search engine optimizers are not necessarily to blame. The algorithm may infer from the phrasing of the search and from related searches by the same user that he or she really is looking for extremist sites. This presents search engine developers with an embarrassing dilemma, appearing to tolerate or even abet violence on the one hand, or appearing to censor expression or police thought on the other. Social media programmers also may aspire to neutrality, but cannot avoid personal bias in writing algorithms. Some conservatives believe Facebook's culture skews its offerings toward liberal sources. Like search engines, social media sites confront a dilemma about controversial results. If their secret formulas are disclosed to demonstrate their fairness, well-funded special interests will exploit them to bend results. But as long as algorithms remain secret, conscious and unconscious manipulation can't be ruled out. Some of the most serious problems of efficiency, though, are free of extremism, commercial fraud, and personal gain. Professional researchers, as well as students, depend on the open-source reference site Wikipedia, created in 2001 after efforts failed to launch a free online encyclopedia written by the same kind of experts who contributed to conventional print reference books. Wikipedia was based on the idea that anybody, regardless of credentials or education level, would be free to create or modify an article, which of course could be modified in turn by other users. It was and remains non-profit and advertising free, relying on volunteers to present evidence on both sides of controversial questions. While Wikipedia's leaders claim that electronic and human oversight have been effective in detecting and eliminating vandalism, new cases still arise, including one long-lasting prank addition to the article on inflammation to the effect that volcanic rock produced by the human body causes inflammation pain. In principle, Wikipedia is self-correcting because so many eyes are on each article. Its mechanism is admirably efficient at including new information, such as the deaths of famous people or revision of borders, that might have taken years in the days of exclusively printed reference books. Best of all, it remains free to anyone with an internet connection, and also free to reprint and adapt. Despite its admirable openness, Wikipedia's efficiency has a self-sabotaging side. It meshes well with search engine algorithms. Wikipedia entries are often top-ranked in Google's search results. But this can also be a threat. Google's own text boxes, compiled by algorithms using information from Wikipedia, compete with the Encyclopedia Project as a source of information and may have reduced traffic to Wikipedia's original entries. The need to protect the site and assure that articles meet high encyclopedia standards has also changed the organization. With multiple levels of privileges and robotic algorithms that can delete apparently non-compliant entries automatically, it has turned from a freewheeling collective to a more tightly run and hierarchical cadre that even admirers warn can be a barrier to keeping content fresh and diverse. Women are notoriously underrepresented among contributors. While the experience of consulting Wikipedia continues to be efficient, and content continues to expand, its operation is more cumbersome. The writer Tom Simonite suggested replacing the "anyone can edit" motto with "the encyclopedia that anyone who understands the norms, socializes him or herself, dodges the impersonal wall of semi-automated rejection, and still wants to voluntarily contribute his or her time and energy, can edit." The contributor of a commercial specialized encyclopedia article usually receives only a small honorarium and may be praised or faulted by colleagues, but at least does not have to worry about the work being deleted or altered arbitrarily by anonymous strangers. Most journalism is still signed and is not open to alteration at will, but it has other technological challenges. The efficiency of mobile computing has had mixed effects on newspaper publishing. At a conference at which I spoke in 1995, run by the Annenberg Washington Program, progressive media critics worried about the growing influence of advertising as news moved to the incipient web. The technology boom, in fact, became a rich source of advertising for newspapers. The circuits section of the New York Times, for example, was fat with advertisements from companies like J&R Music World, a former electronics superstore relatively inactive since 2014, and personal computer manufacturers. Many newspaper publishers and journalists were convinced that editorial quality would prevail in the digital future. Advertisers wanted affluent, educated consumers who in turn would visit sites with authoritative, reliable information. Therefore, while print might be obsolescent, media would migrate successfully. Newsrooms continued to expand in the early web era. The news content of 10 daily papers doubled from 1964 to 1999, according to a Columbia University School of Journalism report published in 2009. There were grounds for optimism in the new millennium, too. Newspaper advertising revenue continued to rise to almost $50 billion in 2005. By 2013, that number had dropped by more than half to $23.6 billion. So discouraging has been the situation that the major trade group, the Newspaper Association of America, now renamed the News Media Alliance, has not released industry-wide advertising statistics since then. Using the data of publicly owned companies that must include the information in shareholder reports, the Pew Research Center has calculated a 6.4% drop in 2014 and a 7.8% drop in 2015. At the same time, there are fewer digital-only newspaper readers than many futurists once expected. More than half of all newspaper readers still limit themselves to print editions. Only 17% of all readers are digital-only news consumers, and only 5% are mobile-only. The rest are format omnivores. Statistics on magazines are harder to find. Aggregate circulation appears stronger than newspaper sales, but advertising is also declining. The problems of newspapers were visible at their peak. The Washington Post cultural reporter Paul Farhi, writing in American Journalism Review in 2005, pointed to the industry's conventional strengths, including local monopolies after consolidation, large reporting staffs, and elite readership. Their profit margins of 23%, according to one analyst, were one of the best of any industry. But Farhi also presciently identified what proved to be an Achilles heel. The strong profits reflected living off capital, raising prices as readership declined while failing to invest in plants and people. Meanwhile, web-based companies began competing for the boring but intensely profitable business of classified advertising, which accounted for fully 36% of newspaper profits. Craigslist was especially damaging in two critical areas. Even with charges for employment ads, it was able to undercut a major profit center of urban dailies, and it damaged alternative newspapers that did not have the retail and corporate display advertising that mainstream papers had been able to retain. In the decade after the high point of profitability, the efficiency of social media in holding readers' attention, plus platform companies' new advertising models, sent newspapers and some magazines into a tailspin. It was bad enough that younger people were abandoning not just print, but digital newspaper reading in favor of new websites and videos, which became competitors for advertising. Google bought the advertising-supported video site YouTube for $1.65 billion in 2006. By 2016, a New York Times article estimated YouTube's annual revenue at between $4 billion and $8 billion. Still worse, the major platform companies have been wresting control of online advertising from newspapers and magazines themselves to arrangements that give decisions on acceptance and placement, as well as a substantial share of revenues to the platforms. Advertising was long a notoriously inefficient business, like the entertainment industries with which it was intertwined. The late 19th century department store magnate John Wanamaker, who helped establish the close connection between great retailers and city newspapers, remains famous for his witticism that half the money he spent on advertising was wasted, but he didn't know which half. Since the early days of the web, entrepreneurs and Silicon Valley have sought to put marketing on a more rational basis by tying it to customer data. User information, including previous purchases and search and browsing patterns, could at least in principle help target advertising. With hypertext and links to other sites, it was also becoming possible to measure not just the number of readers who saw an announcement, impressions, but the proportion who actually visited the advertiser's site. It was as though a traditional direct mail company could tell whether an envelope had been opened or simply discarded. The most successful of the advertising servers has been Google's AdWords. These small notices are shown to readers not by an advertiser's decision that a publication would be a good showplace, which helped sustain Henry Luce's high-priced Fortune magazine during the 1930s, but by the calculations of an algorithm. In place of the old price-per-thousand impressions model is an auction based on the reward an advertiser is willing to pay for each click-through. It can vary from a few cents to $50. Using modern auction theory, which has won the Nobel Prize in economics, Google charges the winner not the full bid, but the amount the runner-up was willing to pay. The rise of Facebook and its expansion from a site for contact among actual friends to a comprehensive portal has created new dilemmas for newspapers. By May 2016, Facebook was claiming an average of 50 minutes of its users' time a day, almost as much as eating and drinking, and almost three times as much as other reading. Early web media specialists liked to talk about retaining eyeballs. Facebook succeeded in commanding attention where so many others, including newspaper sites trying to be all-around urban portals, had failed. Experts have engineered it brilliantly for personalization, surpassing anything else on the web. The Facebook algorithm selects items on an individual's timeline based on a secret psychological format designed to encourage participants to return as often as possible and to spend as much time as possible. The timeline that a participant sees is not the sum of friends' posts, but a selection from them, along with other links made for maximum engagement. Psychologists are still debating whether internet and social media addiction is a widespread problem, and whether extended Facebook use damages health and life satisfaction. Given this attention, licensing newspaper and magazine content was a natural step for Facebook, which, like Google, has become, in effect, a spectacularly profitable advertising agency. There was nothing shocking about the willingness of most website owners to allow the spiders of search engines to index and even store their content. It was all in the interest of getting noticed. Google, aware of growing criticism of its impact on publishers' revenue, has responded by making it easier for them to control the free content they can access through its search engine. They had previously been penalized in search results if they had been too strict about access for non-subscribers. If social media had opened up new advertising markets for newspapers, they would be seen as a benign extension market, much as mass-market paperback reprints and book clubs in the 1920s and 1930s were a net bonus for the book publishing industry. In fact, search and social media advertising did not supplement newspapers' own advertising sales, both print and digital. On balance, they cannibalized them. Just five platform companies, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Yahoo, and Verizon, accounted for more than 65% of digital advertising. From 2014 to 2015, Facebook alone increased its share from 25% to 30%. By early 2016, 85% of new digital advertising revenue was going to Google and Facebook. Unfortunately, the long-term net record of the Internet as a source of media careers in the information age has been dismal. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, combined newspaper and magazine employment declined from 576,200 in March 1996 to 276,800 in March 2016, a net loss of over 50%. Internet publishing and broadcasting jobs meanwhile soared from 32,000 to nearly 200,000. But that was a net gain of only 168,000, little more than half the legacy